Suddenly, I had the feeling I was being watched. A sharp switch in perception. I saw, from some point in the darkness behind a tree, the two of us lying in each other's arms. I looked up to see a boy of 15 or 16 crouching nearby. "Hey!" I shouted. As he stood up, I saw his trousers were open and he was exposed. "What's the matter?" she gasped. I jumped up, and he vanished into the darkness. "Did you see him?" "No," she said, smoothing her skirt nervously. "I didn't see anyone." "Standing right here, watching us, close enough to touch you." "Charlie, where are you going?" He couldn't have gotten very far. "Leave him alone, Charlie, it doesn't matter." But it mattered to me. I ran into the darkness, stumbling over startled couples, but there was no way to tell where he had gone. The more I thought about him, the worse became the queasy feeling that comes before fainting. Lost and alone in a great wilderness. And then I caught hold of myself and found my way back to where Alice was sitting.
"Did you find him?"
"No, but he was there. I saw him."
She looked at me strangely.
"Are you all right?"
"I will be, in a minute. Just that damn buzzing in my ears. Maybe we'd better go."
All the way back to her apartment, it was on my mind that the boy had been crouching there in the darkness, and for one second, I had caught a glimpse of what he was seeing, the two of us lying in each other's arms.
"Would you like to come in? I could make some coffee."
I wanted to, but something warned me against it. "Better not. I've got a lot of work to do tonight."
"Charlie, is it anything I said or did?"
"Of course not. Just that kid watching us upset me." She was standing close to me, waiting for me to kiss her. I put my arm around her, but it happened again. If I didn't get away quickly, I would pass out.
"Charlie, you look sick."
"Did you see him, Alice? The truth?"
She shook her head.
"No.
It was too dark, but I'm sure..."
"I've got to go. I'll call you." And before she could stop me, I pulled away. I had to get out of that building before everything caved in. Thinking about it now, I'm certain it was a hallucination. Dr. Strauss feels that emotionally, I'm still in that adolescent state where being close to a woman or thinking of sex sets off anxiety, panic, even hallucinations. He feels that my rapid intellectual development has deceived me into thinking I could live a normal emotional life. But I've got to accept the fact that the fears and blocks triggered in these sexual situations reveal that emotionally, I'm still an adolescent. Sexually retarded. I guess he means I'm not ready for a relationship with a woman like Alice Kinnean. Not yet.
May 20th. I've been fired from my job at the bakery. I know it was foolish of me to hang on to the past, but there was something about the place, with its white brick walls browned by oven heat. It was home to me. What did I do to make them hate me so? I can't blame Donner. He's got to think of his business and the other employees. And yet, he's been closer to me than a father. He called me into his office, cleared the statements and bills off the solitary chair beside his roll-top desk, and without looking up at me, he said,
"I've been meaning to talk to you. Now is as good a time as any."
It seems foolish now, but as I sat there staring at him, short, chubby, with the ragged light brown mustache comically drooping over his upper lip, it was as if both of me, the old Charlie and the new, were sitting on that chair, frightened at what old Mr. Donner was going to say.
"Charlie, Your Uncle Herman was a good friend of mine. I kept my promise to him to keep you on the job, good times and bad, so that you didn't ever want for a dollar in your pocket and a place to lay your head without being put away in that home. The bakery is my home, and I treated you like my own son, who gave up his life for his country. And when Herman died, how old were you, 17? More like a 6-year-old boy. I swore to myself. I said, Arthur Donner, as long as you got a bakery and a business over your head, you're going to look after Charlie. He's going to have a place to work, a bed to sleep in, and bread in his mouth. When they committed you to that Warren place, I told them how you'd work for me and I'd take care of you. You didn't spend even one night in that place. I got you a room and I looked after you. Now, have I kept that solemn promise? I nodded, but I could see by the way he was folding and unfolding his bills that he was having trouble. And as much as I didn't want to know, I knew. I've tried my best to do a good job. I've worked hard. I know, Charlie. Nothing's wrong with your work. But something happened to you, and I don't understand what it means. Not only me, everyone has been talking about it. I've had them in here a dozen times in the last few weeks. They're all upset. Charlie, I gotta let you go. I tried to stop him, but he shook his head. There was a delegation in to see me last night. Charlie, I got my business to hold together. He was staring at his hands, turning the paper over and over as if he hoped to find something on it that wasn't there before. I'm sorry, Charlie. But where will I go? He peered up at me for the first time since we'd walked into his cubbyhole office. You know as well as I do that you don't need to work here anymore. Mr. Donner, I've never worked anywhere else. Let's face it, you're not the Charlie who came in here 17 years ago. Not even the same Charlie of 4 months ago. You haven't talked about it. It's your own affair, maybe a miracle of some kind, who knows. But you've changed into a very smart young man. And operating the dough mixer and delivering packages is no work for a smart young man. He was right, of course, but something inside me wanted to make him change his mind. You've got to let me stay, Mr. Donner. Give me another chance. You said yourself that you promised Uncle Herman I would have a job here for as long as I needed it. Well, I still need it, Mr. Donner.
You don't, Charlie. If you did, then I'd tell them I don't care about their delegations and their petitions, and I'd stick up for you against all of them. But as it is now, they're all scared to death of you. I gotta think of my own family, too.
What if they change their minds? Let me try to convince them. I was making it harder for him than he expected. I knew I should stop, but I couldn't control myself. I'll make them understand, I pleaded.
All right, he sighed finally. Go ahead, try. But you're only going to hurt yourself.
As I came out of his office, Frank Riley and Joe Karp walked by me, and I knew what he had said was true. Having me around to look at was too much for them. I made them all uncomfortable. Frank had just picked up a tray of rolls, and both he and Joe turned when I called.
Look, Charlie, I'm busy, maybe later.
No, I insisted. Now, right now. Both of you have been avoiding me. Why? Frank, the fast talker, the ladies' man, the arranger, studied me for a moment and then set the tray down on the table.
Why? I'll tell you why. Because all of a sudden you're a big shot, a know-it-all, a brain. Now you're a regular whiz kid, an egghead, always with a book, always with all the answers.
Well, I'll tell you something. You think you're better than the rest of us here? Okay, go someplace else.
But what did I do to you?
What did he do? Hear that, Joe?
I'll tell you what you did, Mr. Gordon. You come pushing in here with your ideas and suggestions and make the rest of us all look like a bunch of dopes. But I'll tell you something. To me, you're still a moron. Maybe I don't understand some of them big words or the names of the books, but I'm as good as you are, better even.
Yeah.
Joe nodded, turning to emphasize the point to Gimpy, who had just come up behind him. I'm not asking you to be my friends, I said, or have anything to do with me. Just let me keep my job. Mr. Donner says it's up to you. Gimpy glared at me, and then shook his head in disgust.
You got a nerve, he shouted. You can go to hell.
Then he turned and limped off heavily. And so it went. Most of them felt the way Joe and Frank and Gimpy did. It had been all right as long as they could laugh at me and appear clever at my expense, but now they were feeling inferior to the moron. I began to see that by my astonishing growth, I had made them shrink and emphasize their inadequacies. I had betrayed them, and they hated me for it. Fanny Burden was the only one who didn't think I should be forced to leave, and despite their pressure and threats, she had been the only one not to sign the petition.
"Which don't mean to say," she remarked, "that I don't think there's something mighty strange about you, Charlie. The way you've changed, I don't know. You used to be a good, dependable man, ordinary, not too bright maybe, but honest. And who knows what you'd done to yourself to get so smart all of a sudden. Like everybody's been saying, it ain't right."
But what's wrong with a person wanting to be more intelligent, to acquire knowledge and understand himself and the world?
If you'd read your Bible, Charlie, you'd know that it's not meant for man to know more than was given to him to know by the Lord in the first place. The fruit of that tree was forbidden to man. Charlie, if you'd done anything you wasn't supposed to, you know, like with the devil or something, maybe it ain't too late to get out of it. Maybe you could go back to being the good, simple man you was before.
There's no going back, Fanny. I haven't done anything wrong. I'm like a man born blind who has been given a chance to see light. That can't be sinful. Soon there'll be millions like me all over the world. Science can do it, Fanny.
She stared down at the bride and groom on the wedding cake she was decorating, and I could see her lips barely move as she whispered, "It was evil when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge. It was evil when they saw they was naked and learned about lust and shame. And they was driven out of paradise, and the gates was closed to them. If not for that, none of us would have to grow old and be sick and die."
There was nothing more to say, to her or to the rest of them. None of them would look into my eyes. I can still feel the hostility. Before, they had laughed at me, despising me for my ignorance and dullness. Now they hated me for my knowledge and understanding.
Why? What in God's name did they want of me?
This intelligence has driven a wedge between me and all the people I knew and loved, driven me out of the bakery. Now I'm more alone than ever before. I wonder what would happen if they put Algernon back in the big cage with some of the other mice. Would they turn against him?
May 25th. So this is how a person can come to despise himself, knowing he's doing the wrong thing and not being able to stop. Against my will, I found myself drawn to Alice's apartment. She was surprised, but she let me in.
"You're soaked. The water is streaming down your face."
"It's raining. Good for the flowers."
"Come on in. Let me get you a towel. You'll catch pneumonia."
"You're the only one I can talk to," I said. "Let me stay."
"I've got a pot of fresh coffee on the stove. Go ahead and dry yourself, and then we can talk." I looked around while she went to get the coffee. It was the first time I had ever been inside her apartment. I felt a sense of pleasure, but there was something disturbing about the room. Everything was neat. The porcelain figurines were in a straight line on the window ledge, all facing the same way. And the throw pillows on the sofa hadn't been thrown at all.
but were regularly spaced on the clear plastic covers that protected the upholstery. Two of the end tables had magazines, neatly stacked so that the titles were clearly visible. On one table, The Reporter, The Saturday Review, The New Yorker. On the other, Mademoiselle, House Beautiful, and Reader's Digest. On the far wall, across from the sofa, hung an ornately framed reproduction of Picasso's Mother and Child, and directly opposite, above the sofa, was a painting of a dashing Renaissance courtier, masked, sword in hand, protecting a frightened, pink-cheeked maiden. Taken altogether, it was wrong, as if Alice couldn't make up her mind who she was and which world she wanted to live in. "You haven't been to the lab for a few days," she called from the kitchen. "Professor Niemer is worried about you." "I couldn't face them," I said. "I know there's no reason for me to be ashamed, but it's an empty feeling not going into work every day, not seeing the shop, the ovens, the people. It's too much. Last night and the night before, I had nightmares of drowning." She set the tray in the center of the coffee table, the napkins folded into triangles, and the cookies laid out in a circular display pattern. "You mustn't take it so hard, Charlie. It has nothing to do with you." It doesn't help to tell myself that. Those people, for all these years, were my family. It was like being thrown out of my own home. "That's just it," she said. "This has become a symbolic repetition of experiences you had as a child. Being rejected by your parents, being sent away..." "Oh, Christ, never mind giving it a nice, neat label. What matters is that before I got involved in this experiment, I had friends. People who cared for me. Now, I'm afraid you've still got friends. It's not the same. Fear is a normal reaction." "It's more than that. I've been afraid before. Afraid of being strapped for not giving in to Norma. Afraid of passing Howell's Street, where the gang used to tease me and push me around. And I was afraid of the schoolteacher, Mrs. Libby, who tied my hands so I wouldn't fidget with things on my desk. But those things were real, something I was justified in being afraid of. This terror at being kicked out of the bakery is vague, a fear I don't understand." "Get hold of yourself. You don't feel the panic." "But, Charlie, it's to be expected. You're a new swimmer, forced off a diving raft and terrified of losing the solid wood under your feet. Mr. Donner was good to you, and you were sheltered all these years. Being driven out of the bakery this way is an even greater shock than you expected." "Knowing it intellectually doesn't help. I can't sit alone in my room anymore. I wander into the streets at all hours of the day or night, not knowing what I'm looking for, walking until I'm lost, finding myself outside the bakery. Last night, I walked all the way from Washington Square to Central Park, and I slept in the park. What the hell am I searching for?" The more I talked, the more upset she became. "What can I do to help you, Charlie?" "I don't know. I'm like an animal who's been locked out of his nice, safe cage." She sat beside me on the couch. "They're pushing you too fast. You're confused. You want to be an adult, but there's still a little boy inside you. Alone and frightened." She put my head on her shoulder, trying to comfort me, and as she stroked my hair, I knew that she needed me the way I needed her. "Charlie," she whispered after a while, "whatever you want, don't be afraid of me." I wanted to tell her I was waiting for the panic. Once, during a bakery delivery, Charlie had nearly fainted when a middle-aged woman just out of the bath amused herself by opening her bathrobe and exposing herself. Had he ever seen a woman without clothes on? Did he know how to make love? His terror, his whining, must have frightened her, because she clutched her robe together and gave him a quarter to forget what had happened. She was only testing him, she warned, to see if he was a good boy.
He tried to be good, he told her, and not look at women, because his mother used to beat him whenever that happened in his pants. Now, he had the clear picture of Charlie's mother, screaming at him, holding a leather belt in her hand, and his father trying to hold her back. "Enough, Rose, you'll kill him, leave him alone!" His mother straining forward to lash at him, just out of reach now, so that the belt swishes past his shoulder as he writhes and twists away from it on the floor. "Look at him!" Rose screams. "He can't learn to read and write, but he knows enough to look at a girl that way. I'll beat that filth out of his mind." "He can't help it if he gets an erection. It's normal. He didn't do anything. He's got no business to think that way about girls. A friend of his sister's comes to the house and he starts thinking like that. I'll teach him so he never forgets. Do you hear? If you ever touch a girl, I'll put you away in a cage, like an animal, for the rest of your life. Do you hear me?" I still hear her. But perhaps I had been released. Maybe the fear and nausea was no longer a sea to drown in, but only a pool of water reflecting the past alongside the now. Was I free? If I could reach Alice in time, without thinking about it, before it overwhelmed me, maybe the panic wouldn't happen. If only I could make my mind a blank. I managed to choke out, You do it. Hold me." And before I knew what she was doing, she was kissing me, holding me closer than anyone had ever held me before. But at the moment I should have come closest of all, it started. The buzzing, the chill, and the nausea. I turned away from her. She tried to soothe me, to tell me it didn't matter, that there was no reason to blame myself. But ashamed and no longer able to control my anguish, I began to sob. There, in her arms, I cried myself to sleep, and I dreamed of the courtier and the pink-cheeked maiden. But in my dream, it was the maiden who held the sword.
This ends Disc 3. Flowers for Algernon, Disc 4.
Progress Report 12, June 5th. Niemer is upset because I haven't turned in any progress reports in almost 2 weeks. And he's justified because the Wellberg Foundation has begun paying me a salary out of the grant so that I won't have to look for a job. The International Psychological Convention at Chicago is only a week away. He wants his preliminary report to be as full as possible, since Algernon and I are the prime exhibits for his presentation. Our relationship is becoming increasingly strained. I resent Niemer's constant references to me as a laboratory specimen. He makes me feel that before the experiment, I wasn't really a human being. I told Strauss that I was too involved in thinking, reading, and digging into myself, trying to understand who and what I am, and that writing was such a slow process it made me impatient to get my ideas down. I followed his suggestion that I learn to type, and now that I can type nearly 75 words a minute, it's easier to get it all down on paper. Strauss again brought up my need to speak and write simply and directly so that people will understand me. He reminds me that language is sometimes a barrier instead of a pathway. Ironic to find myself on the other side of the intellectual fence. I see Alice occasionally, but we don't discuss what happened. Our relationship remains platonic. But for 3 nights after I left the bakery, there were the nightmares. Hard to believe it was 2 weeks ago. I'm pursued down the empty streets at night by ghostly figures. Though I always run to the bakery, the door is locked, and the people inside never turn to look at me. Through the window, the bride and groom on the wedding cake point at me and laugh. The air becomes charged with laughter until I can't stand it, and the two cupids wave their flaming arrows. I scream, I pound on the door, but there's no sound.
I see Charlie staring back at me from inside. Is it only a reflection? Things clutch at my legs and drag me away from the bakery, down into the shadows of the alleyway, and just as they begin to ooze all over me, I wake up. Other times, the window of the bakery opens into the past, and looking through it, I see other things and other people. It's astonishing how my power of recall is developing. I cannot control it completely yet, but sometimes when I'm busy reading or working on a problem, I get a feeling of intense clarity. I know it's some kind of subconscious warning signal, and now, instead of waiting for the memory to come to me, I close my eyes and reach out for it. Eventually, I'll be able to bring this recall completely under control, to explore not only the sum of my past experiences, but also all of the untapped faculties of the mind. Even now, as I think about it, I feel the sharp stillness. I see the bakery window, reach out and touch it, cold and vibrating, and then the glass becomes warm, hotter, fingers burning. The window reflecting my image becomes bright, and as the glass turns into a mirror, I see little Charlie Gordon, 14 or 15, looking out at me through the window of his house, and it's doubly strange to realize how different he was. He has been waiting for his sister to come from school, and when he sees her turn the corner onto Mark Street, he waves and calls her name, and runs out onto the porch to meet her. Norma waves a paper.
I got an A in my history test. I knew all the answers. Mrs. Baffin said it was the best paper in the whole class.
She's a pretty girl, with light brown hair carefully braided and coiled about her head in a crown. And as she looks up at her big brother, the smile turns to a frown, and she skips away, leaving him behind as she darts up the steps into the house. Smiling, he follows her. His mother and father are in the kitchen, and Charlie, bursting with the excitement of Norma's good news, blurts it out before she has a chance.
She got an A, she got an A!
No, shrieks Norma.
Not you! You don't tell, it's my mark, and I'm gonna tell.
Now wait a minute, young lady.
Matt puts his newspaper down and addresses her sternly.
That's no way to talk to your brother.
He had no right to tell.
Never mind.
Matt glares at her over his warning finger.
He meant no harm by it, and you mustn't shout at him that way.
She turns to her mother for support.
I got an A, the best mark in class. Now I can have a dog? You promised. You said if I got a good mark in my test, and I got an A. A brown dog with white spots, and I'm going to call him Napoleon because that was the question I answered best on the test. Napoleon lost the Battle of Waterloo.
Rose nods.
Go out on the porch and play with Charlie. He's been waiting over an hour for you to come home from school.
I don't want to play with him.
Go out on the porch, says Matt.
Norma looks at her father and then at Charlie.
I don't have to. Mother said I don't have to play with him if I don't want to.
Now, young lady,
Matt rises out of his chair and comes toward her.
You just apologize to your brother.
I don't have to,
she screeches, rushing behind her mother's chair.
He's like a baby. He can't play Monopoly or checkers or anything. He gets everything all mixed up. I won't play with him anymore.
Then go to your room.
Can I have a dog now, Mama?
Matt hits the table with his fist.
There'll be no dog in this house as long as you take this attitude, young lady.
I promised her a dog if she did well in school. A brown one with white spots, adds Norma.
Matt points to Charlie standing near the wall.
Did you forget you told your son he couldn't have one because we didn't have the room and no one to take care of it, remember? When he asked for a dog? Are you going back on what you said to him?
But I can take care of my own dog,
insists Norma.
I'll feed him and wash him and take him out.
Charlie, who has been standing near the table, playing with his large red button at the end of a string, suddenly speaks out.
I'll help her take care of the dog. I'll help her feed it and brush it, and I won't let the other dogs bite it.
But before either Matt or Rose can answer, Norma shrieks,
No! It's going to be my dog, only my dog.
Matt nods. You see? Rose sits beside her and strokes her braids to calm her.
But we have to share things, dear. Charlie can help you take care of it.
No, only mine. I'm the one who got the A in history, not him. He never gets good marks like me. Why should he help with the dog? And then the dog will like him more than me and it'll be his dog instead of mine. No, if I can't have it for myself, I don't want it.
That settles it, says Matt, picking up his newspaper and settling down in his chair again. No dog. Suddenly, Norma jumps off the couch and grabs the history test she had brought home so eagerly just a few minutes earlier. She tears it and throws the pieces into Charlie's startled face.
I hate you. I hate you. Norma, stop that at once.
Rose grabs her, but she twists away.
And I hate school. I hate it. I'll stop studying, and I'll be a dummy like him. I'll forget everything I learned, and then I'll be just like him.
She runs out of the room, shrieking,
It's happening to me already. I'm forgetting everything. I'm forgetting. I don't remember anything I learned anymore.
Rose, terrified, runs after her. Matt sits there, staring at the newspaper in his lap. Charlie, frightened by the hysteria and the screaming, shrinks into a chair, whimpering softly. What has he done wrong? And feeling the wetness in his trousers and the trickling down his leg, he sits there, waiting for the slap he knows will come when his mother returns. The scene fades, but from that time, Norma spent all her free moments with her friends, or playing alone in her room. She kept the door to her room closed, and I was forbidden to enter without her permission. I recall once overhearing Norma and one of her girlfriends playing in her room, and Norma shouting,
He's not my real brother. He's just a boy we took in because we felt sorry for him. My mama told me, and she said I can tell everyone now, that he's not really my brother at all.
I wish this memory were a photograph, so that I could tear it up and throw it back into her face. I want to call back across the years and tell her I never meant to stop her from getting her dog. She could have had it all to herself, and I wouldn't have fed it or brushed it or played with it. And I would never have made it like me more than it liked her. I only wanted her to play games with me the way we used to. I never meant to do anything that would hurt her at all.
June 6th. My first real quarrel with Alice today. My fault. I wanted to see her. Often, after a disturbing memory or dream, talking to her, just being with her, makes me feel better. But it was a mistake to go down to the center to pick her up. I hadn't been back to the Center for Retarded Adults since the operation, and the thought of seeing the place was exciting. It's on 23rd Street, east of 5th Avenue, in an old schoolhouse that has been used by the Beekman University Clinic for the last 5 years as a center for experimental education, special classes for the handicapped. The sign outside on the doorway, framed by the old spiked gateway, is just a gleaming brass plate that says, CRA Beekman Extension. Her class ended at 8, but I wanted to see the room where, not so long ago, I had struggled over simple reading and writing and learned to count change of a dollar. I went inside, slipped up to the door, and keeping out of sight, I looked through the window. Alice was at her desk, and in a chair beside her was a thin-faced woman I didn't recognize. She was frowning that open frown of unconcealed puzzlement, and I wondered what Alice was trying to explain. Near the blackboard was Mike Dorney in his wheelchair, and there in his usual first row, first seat, was Lester Braun, who Alice said was the smartest in the group. Lester had learned easily what I had struggled over, but he came when he felt like it, or he stayed away to earn money waxing floors. I guess if he had cared at all, if it had been important to him as it was to me, they would have used him for this experiment. There were new faces, too, people I didn't know. Finally, I got up the nerve to go in.
"It's Charlie,"
said Mike, whirling his wheelchair around. I waved to him. Bernice, the pretty blonde with empty eyes, looked up and smiled dully.
"Where you been, Charlie? That's a nice suit."
The others who remembered me waved to me, and I waved back. Suddenly, I could see by Alice's expression that she was annoyed. "It's almost 8 o'clock," she announced. "Time to put things away." Each person had an assigned task, the putting away of chalk, erasers, papers, books, pencils, notepaper, paints, and demonstration material. Each one knew his job and took pride in doing it well. They all started on their tasks except Bernice. She was staring at me.
"Why ain't Charlie been coming to school?" asked Bernice. "What's the matter, Charlie? Are you coming back?"
The others looked up at me. I looked to Alice, waiting for her to answer for me, and there was a long silence. What could I tell them that wouldn't hurt them? "This is just a visit," I said. One of the girls started to giggle, Francine, whom Alice was always worried about. She had given birth to 3 children by the time she was 18, before her parents arranged for a hysterectomy. She wasn't pretty, not nearly as attractive as Bernice, but she had been an easy mark for dozens of men who bought her something pretty or paid her way to the movies. She lived at a boarding house approved for outside work trainees by the Warren State Home and was permitted out in the evenings to come to the center. 2 times she hadn't shown up, picked up by men on the way to school, and now she was allowed out only with an escort.
"He talks like a big shot now,"
she giggled. "All right," said Alice, breaking in sharply. "Class dismissed. I'll see you all tomorrow night at 6. When they were gone, I could see by the way she was slamming her own things into her closet that she was angry. "I'm sorry," I said. "I was going to wait for you downstairs, and then I got curious about the old classroom, my alma mater. I just wanted to look through the window, and before I knew what I was doing, I came in. What's bothering you?" "Nothing. Nothing's bothering me." "Come on, your anger is all out of proportion to what's happened. Something's on your mind." She slammed down a book she was holding. "All right. You want to know? You're different. You've changed, and I'm not talking about your IQ. It's your attitude toward people. You're not the same kind of human being." "Oh, come on now. Don't interrupt me." The real anger in her voice pushed me back. "I mean it. There was something in you before, I don't know, a warmth, an openness, a kindness that made everyone like you and like to have you around. Now, with all your intelligence and knowledge, there are differences that..." I couldn't let myself listen. "What did you expect? Did you think I'd remain a docile pup, wagging my tail and licking the foot that kicks me? Sure, all this has changed me, and the way I think about myself. I no longer have to take the kind of crap that people have been handing me all my life." "People haven't been bad to you. What do you know about it? Listen, the best of them have been smug and patronizing, using me to make themselves superior and secure in their own limitations. Anyone can feel intelligent beside a moron." After I said it, I knew she was going to take it the wrong way. "You put me in that category, too, I suppose." "Don't be absurd. You know damned well I..." "Of course, in a sense, I guess you're right. Next to you, I am rather dull-witted. Nowadays, every time we see each other, after I leave you, I go home with the miserable feeling that I'm slow and dense about everything. I review things I've said and come up with all the bright and witty things I should have said, and I feel like kicking myself because I didn't mention them when we were together." "That's a common experience." "I find myself wanting to impress you in a way I never thought about doing before. But being with you has undermined my self-confidence. I question my motives now about everything I do."
I tried to get her off the subject, but she kept coming back to it. "Look, I didn't come here to argue with you," I finally said. "Will you let me take you home? I need someone to talk to." "So do I. But these days I can't talk to you. All I can do is listen and nod my head and pretend I understand all about cultural variance and neo-Boolean mathematics and post-symbolic logic, and I feel more and more stupid. And when you leave the apartment, I have to stare in the mirror and scream at myself, 'No, you're not growing duller every day. You're not losing your intelligence. You're not getting senile and dull-witted. It's Charlie exploding forward so quickly that it makes it appear as if you're slipping backwards.' I say that to myself, Charlie, but whenever we meet and you tell me something and look at me in that impatient way, I know you're laughing. And when you explain things to me and I can't remember them, you think it's because I'm not interested and don't want to take the trouble. But you don't know how I torture myself when you're gone. You don't know the books I've struggled over, the lectures I've sat in on at Beekman. And yet, whenever I talk about something, I see how impatient you are, as if it were all childish. I wanted you to be intelligent. I wanted to help you and share with you. And now you've shut me out of your life." As I listened to what she was saying, the enormity of it dawned on me. I had been so absorbed in myself and what was happening to me that I never thought about what was happening to her. She was crying silently as we left the school, and I found myself without words. All during the ride on the bus, I thought to myself how upside down the situation had become. She was terrified of me. The ice had broken between us, and the gap was widening as the current of my mind carried me swiftly into the open sea. She was right in refusing to torture herself by being with me. We no longer had anything in common. Simple conversation had become strained, and all there was between us now was the embarrassed silence and unsatisfied longing in a darkened room. "You're very serious," she said, breaking out of her own mood and looking up at me. "About us." "It shouldn't make you so serious. I don't want to upset you. You're going through a great trial." She was trying to smile. "But you did. Only I don't know what to do about it." On the way from the bus stop to her apartment, she said, "I'm not going to the convention with you. I called Professor Niemer this morning and told him. There'll be a lot for you to do there. Interesting people, the excitement of the spotlight for a while. I don't want to be in the way." "Alice, and no matter what you say about it now, I know that's how I'm going to feel. So if you don't mind, I'll hang on to my splintering ego, thank you." "But you're making more of this than it is. I'm sure if you'll just..." "You know? You're sure?" She turned and glared at me on the front steps of her apartment building. "Oh, how insufferable you've become. How do you know what I feel? You take liberties with other people's minds. You can't tell how I feel, or what I feel, or why I feel." She started inside, and then she looked back at me, her voice shaky. "I'll be here when you get back. I'm just upset, that's all. And I want both of us to have a chance to think this out while we're a good distance apart." For the first time in many weeks, she didn't ask me inside. I stared at the closed door with the anger mounting inside me. I wanted to create a scene, to bang on the door, to break it down. I wanted my anger to consume the building. But as I walked away, I felt a kind of simmering, then cooling, and finally, a relief. I walked so fast I was drifting along the streets, and the feeling that hit my cheek was a cool breeze out of the summer night. Suddenly free. I realize now that my feeling for Alice had been moving backward against the current of my learning, from worship to love to fondness to a feeling of gratitude and responsibility. My confused feeling for her had been holding me back, and I had clung to her out of my fear of being forced out on my own, and cut adrift. But with the freedom came a sadness. I wanted to be in love with her. I wanted to overcome my emotional and sexual fears, to marry, have children, settle down. Now it's impossible. I'm just as far away from Alice with an IQ of 185 as I was when I had an IQ of 70. And this time, we both know it.
June 8th.
What drives me out of the apartment to prowl through the city? I wander through the streets alone, not the relaxing stroll of a summer night, but the tense hurry to get... where? Down alleyways, looking into doorways, peering into half-shuttered windows, wanting someone to talk to and yet afraid to meet anyone. Up one street and down another, through the endless labyrinth, hurling myself against the neon cage of the city, searching for what? I met a woman in Central Park. She was sitting on a bench near the lake with a coat clutched around her despite the heat. She smiled and motioned for me to sit beside her. We looked at the bright skyline on Central Park South, the honeycomb of lighted cells against the blackness, and I wished I could absorb them all. Yes, I told her, I was from New York. No, I had never been to Newport News, Virginia. That's where she was from, and where she had married this sailor who was at sea now, and she hadn't seen him in 2.5 years. She twisted and knotted a handkerchief, using it from time to time to wipe the beaded sweat from her forehead. Even in the dim light reflected from the lake, I could see that she wore a great deal of makeup. But she looked attractive, with her straight dark hair loose to her shoulders, except that her face was puffy and swollen as if she had just gotten up from sleep. She wanted to talk about herself, and I wanted to listen. Her father had given her a good home, an education, everything a wealthy shipbuilder could give his only daughter, but not forgiveness. He would never forgive her elopement with the sailor. She took my hand as she spoke and rested her head on my shoulder. "The night Gary and I were married," she whispered, "I was a terrified virgin. And he just went crazy. First he had to slap me and beat me, and then he took me with no lovemaking. That was the last time we were ever together. I never let him touch me again." She could probably tell by the trembling of my hand that I was startled. It was too violent and intimate for me. Feeling my hand stir, she gripped it tighter, as if she had to finish her story before she could let me go. It was important to her, and I sat quietly, as one sits before a bird that feeds from your palm. "Not that I don't like men," she assured me with wide-eyed openness. "I've been with other men. Not him, but lots of others. Most men are gentle and tender with a woman. They make love slowly, with caresses and kisses first." She looked at me meaningfully and let her open palm brush back and forth against mine. It was what I had heard about, read about, dreamed about. I didn't know her name and she didn't ask mine. She just wanted me to take her someplace where we could be alone. I wondered what Alice would think. I caressed her awkwardly and kissed her still more hesitantly so that she looked up at me.
"What's the matter?" she whispered. "What are you thinking?"
"About you."
"Do you have a place we can go?"
Each step forward was caution. At what point would the ground give way and plunge me into anxiety? Something kept me moving ahead to test my footing.
"If you don't have a place, the Mansion Hotel on 53rd doesn't cost too much, and they don't bother you about luggage if you pay in advance."
"I have a room." She looked at me with new respect.
"Well, that's fine."
Still nothing. And that in itself was curious. How far could I go without being overwhelmed by symptoms of panic? When we were alone in the room,
when she undressed, when I saw her body, when we were lying together. Suddenly, it was important to know if I could be like other men, if I could ever ask a woman to share a life with me. Having intelligence and knowledge wasn't enough. I wanted this, too. The sense of release and looseness was strong now, with the feeling that it was possible. The excitement that came over me when I kissed her again communicated itself, and I was sure I could be normal with her. She was different from Alice. She was the kind of woman who had been around. Then her voice changed, uncertain. "Before we go, just one thing." She stood up and took a step toward me in the spray of lamplight, opening her coat, and I could see the shape of her body as I had not imagined it all the time we were sitting next to each other in the shadows. "Only the fifth month," she said. "It doesn't make any difference. You don't mind, do you?" Standing there with her coat open, she was superimposed as a double exposure on the picture of the middle-aged woman just out of the bathtub holding open her bathrobe for Charlie to see. And I waited, as a blasphemer waits for lightning. I looked away. It was the last thing I had expected, but the coat wrapped tightly around her on such a hot night should have warned me that something was wrong. "It's not my husband's," she assured me. "I wasn't lying to you about what I said before. I haven't seen him for years. It was a salesman I met about 8 months ago. I was living with him. I'm not going to see him anymore, but I'm going to keep the baby. We've just got to be careful, not rough or anything like that. But otherwise, you don't have to worry." Her voice ran down when she saw my anger. "That's filthy," I shouted. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself." She drew away, wrapping her coat quickly around her to protect what lay within. As she made that protective gesture, I saw the second double image. My mother, heavy with my sister, in the days when she was holding me less, warming me less with her voice and touch, protecting me less against anyone who dared to say I was subnormal. I think I grabbed her shoulder, I'm not sure, but then she was screaming, and I was sharply back to reality with the sense of danger. I wanted to tell her I had meant no harm, I would never hurt her or anyone. "Please, don't scream." But she was screaming, and I heard the running footsteps on the darkened path. This was something no one would understand. I ran into the darkness to find an exit from the park, zigzagging across one path and down another. I didn't know the park, and suddenly I crashed into something that threw me backwards. A wire mesh fence, a dead end. Then I saw the swings and slides and realized it was a children's playground locked up for the night. I followed the fence and kept going, half running, stumbling over twisted roots. At the lake that curved around near the playground, I doubled back, found another path, went over the small footbridge, and then around and under it. No exit.
"What is it? What happened, lady?"
"A maniac."
"You all right?"
"Which way did he go?"
I had circled back to where I had started from. I slipped behind the huge outcropping of a rock and a screen of bramble and dropped flat on my stomach.
"Get a cop. There's never a cop when you need one."
"What happened?"
"A degenerate tried to rape her."
"Hey, some guy down there is chasing him. There he goes."
"Come on, get the bastard before he gets out of the park."
"Careful, he's got a knife and a gun."
It was obvious that the shouting had flushed out the night crawlers, because the cry of "There he goes" was echoed from behind me, and looking out from behind the rock, I could see a lone runner being chased down the lamplit path into the darkness. Seconds later, another one passed in front of the rock and disappeared into the shadows. I pictured myself being caught by this eager mob and beaten and torn by them. I deserved it. I almost wanted it. I stood up, brushed the leaves and dirt from my clothing, and walked slowly down the path in the direction from which I had come. I expected every second to be grabbed from behind and pulled down into the dirt and darkness, but soon I saw the bright lights of 59th Street and 5th Avenue, and I came out of the park.
Thinking about it now, in the security of my room, I'm shaken with the rawness that touched me. Remembering how my mother looked before she gave birth to my sister is frightening. But even more frightening is the feeling that I wanted them to catch me and beat me. Why did I want to be punished? Shadows out of the past clutch at my legs and drag me down. I open my mouth to scream, but I'm voiceless. My hands are trembling. I feel cold, and there's a distant humming in my ears. Progress Report 13, June 10th. We're on a strato jet, about to take off for Chicago. I owe this progress report to Bert, who had the bright idea that I could dictate this on a transistor tape recorder and have a public stenographer in Chicago type it up. Niemer likes the idea. In fact, he wants me to use the recorder up to the last minute. He feels it will add to the report if they play the most recent tape at the end of the session. So, here I am, sitting off by myself in our private section of a jet on the way to Chicago, trying to get used to thinking aloud and to the sound of my own voice. I suppose the typist can get rid of all the ums, ers, and ahs and make it all seem natural on paper. I can't help the paralysis that comes over me when I think hundreds of people are going to listen to the words I'm saying now. My mind is a blank. At this point, my feelings are more important than anything else. The idea of going up in the air terrifies me. As far as I can tell, in the days before the operation, I never really understood what planes were. I never connected the movies and TV close-ups of planes with the things that I saw zooming overhead. Now that we're about to take off, I can think only of what might happen if we crash. A cold feeling, and the thought that I don't want to die, brings to mind those discussions about God. I've thought about death often in recent weeks, but not really about God. My mother took me to church occasionally, but I don't recall ever connecting that up with the thought of God. She mentioned him quite often, and I had to pray to him at night, but I never thought much about it. I remember him as a distant uncle with a long beard on a throne, like Santa Claus in the department store in his big chair, who picks you up on his knee and asks you if you've been good, and what would you like him to give you? She was afraid of him, but asked favors anyway. My father never mentioned him. It was as if God was one of Rose's relatives he'd rather not get involved with. "We're ready to take off, sir. May I help you fasten your seatbelt?" "Do I have to? I don't like to be strapped down." "Until we're airborne." "I'd rather not, unless it's necessary. I've got this fear of being strapped in. It'll probably make me sick." "It's regulations, sir. Here, let me help you." "No, I'll do it myself." "No, that one goes through here. Wait, okay." Ridiculous. There's nothing to be afraid of. Seatbelt isn't too tight, doesn't hurt. Why should putting on the damned seatbelt be so terrifying? That and the vibrations of the plane taking off. Anxiety all out of proportion to the situation, so it must be something. What? Flying up into and through dark clouds. Fasten your seatbelts. Strapped down, straining forward, odor of sweaty leather, vibrations and a roaring sound in my ears. Through the window, in the clouds, I see Charlie. Age is difficult to tell, about 5 years old, before Norma.
"Are you two ready yet?"
His father comes to the doorway, heavy, especially in the sagging fleshiness of his face and neck. He has a tired look.
"I said, are you ready?"
"Just a minute," answers Rose. "I'm getting my hat on. See if his shirt is buttoned and tie his shoelaces."
"Come on, let's get this thing over with."
"Where?"
asks Charlie.
Where Charlie go?